You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Henry Crumpton was just 10 years old when he wrote a letter to the local CIA office expressing his desire to join the agency. 12 years later, Mr. Crumpton was given the opportunity to do so, beginning a 24-year career. He also served as the U.S. Coordinator of Counterterrorism with the rank of Ambassador at Large. He's currently the CEO of the Crumpton Group, LLC, a global business advisory firm. And he chronicles his experiences at the CIA, the covert missions that brought him from Africa to Afghanistan, in his book, The Art of Intelligence, Lessons from a Life in the CIA's Clandestine Service. It's published by Penguin. I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Isn't it difficult to write about one's experience in the CIA because everything has to be vetted?
Well, there's so many human interest stories. I had lots of material to work with. And I wrote the book with the responsibility of a CIA officer retired, knowing they had to protect sources and methods. And the CIA's Publication Review Board was very cooperative, very professional, very quick in working through the manuscript.
In your introduction, you write that our nation's collective ignorance of intelligence has undermined not only our intelligence capabilities, but ultimately the policymakers and citizens served. Whom do you blame most for that ignorance?
I think it's a combination of factors. One, the clandestine service itself, by its nature, is very secret, in some ways very closed. And historically, there has not been much engagement with the public. I believe as the value of intelligence grows, the importance of intelligence, particularly to the American people, drives a need to communicate across various industries and various parts of society.
Are the citizens of other countries more informed about their intelligence agencies?
No, I don't think so. I think in general it's a problem.
And it's, of course, the nature of the beast, isn't it?
That's correct. And in some countries, of course, the intelligence services are used by dictatorial governments to stay in power. And it's like any tool, it's how do you use it.
Well, in England, of course, they had James Bond to make MI6 look really good.
Right,
we don't have
right.
a James Bond here.
Well, I think that's part of the issue, is that you see in popular media the CIA officers or intelligence officers in general portrayed either as these comic book superheroes, or they're denigrated as some type of threat to society.
Why did you want to be in the CIA at such an early age?
I was inspired by intellectual curiosity. My mother is a kindergarten teacher, and she taught me to read and write and introduced me at an early age to books. And I explored American history, particularly war, and became infatuated with serving my country as an intelligence officer.
And what did you have to do to get hired?
Well,
Is this a stringent process?
Very, yes. I went through a series of different examinations, psychological examinations, mental testing, security check, including a polygraph exam. That took 9 months to get through that.
They used to recruit recent college graduates. They'd go to the best schools and try to convince people who were graduating that the CIA was a good opportunity. That doesn't happen anymore, does it?
Yes, they still recruit at universities across the nation.
Did it matter that you lacked experience?
Well,
did they just feel that you learned on the job?
Well, I think that if you look at the intelligence business, very few people have the exact experience, and they go through a very rigorous training process. For me, it was 18 months before I was certified to go overseas.
And that you did that process on a place called the farm?
Correct.
Now, did the training turn out to be useful in real-world situations?
No, it was exceedingly useful. It gave me and other officers the foundation for clandestine service, the basics of espionage.
And the people who trained with you, do most of them still remain in the CIA? Did they make a career of it?
Oh, yes. The retention rate in the CIA is exceedingly high, and the overwhelming majority of my fellow classmates back in the early 80s made it a career.
In the 80s, you were sent to work as a recruiter in Africa. You don't mention which country or countries. Is that one of the things that was vetted?
That's correct.
Who were you recruiting?
A variety of different sources, from local Africans to Warsaw Pact officials to terrorists to insurgents to weapon smugglers, just a whole range of targets.
Was there still anger about some of the CIA activities in the years before you arrived? For example, in Congo, where the CIA is alleged to have planned to get rid of Patrice Lumumba before the Belgians actually beat them to it.
Right. In many parts of the world, there's misunderstanding, suspicion, fear when you mention the CIA. But ultimately, it's about establishing individual relationships with people that you hope will cooperate with you.
Well, Africa was actually a place where the Cold War was being fought. I don't know whether you went to Angola, but that was a hot place because you had the Soviets, you had China, and you had the United States all involved in what was a really devastating civil war.
Yes, there were sadly many examples of that throughout the continent, up in the Horn of Africa and in southern Africa, Angola, as you mentioned.
So what kind of intelligence were you gathering from your African sources?
I spent a lot of time looking at African insurgencies and penetrating African insurgent groups to inform policymakers back here about those hot battles of the Cold War.
And I'm assuming that you didn't always look for people who were the most upstanding citizens, because they probably didn't have the best information.
Well, it's the nature of the business that you deal with all types. And I was fortunate that some of my sources were extraordinarily brave and driven by the highest aspirations.
But some were compensated.
Almost all are compensated.
Is that the main reason people are willing to give intelligence?
Leonard, it's a mix of motivations, and I outline these in the book: money, ideology, compromise, ego, revenge, coercion.
And you also had to evaluate these people and what kind of how trustworthy they might be.
Sure.
Do you ever misjudge?
Yes, I have. And in fact, I give an example of that in the book, where a volunteer offering secret information to the U.S. did indeed provide some, but he fabricated much, and it was a scam. And it took me a few months with the help of some specialists to understand that and to basically fire him.
There have been any number of people who have given misinformation over the years. Maybe we'll deal with some of that along the line. My guest is Henry A. Crumpton. His book, The Art of Intelligence, Lessons from a Life in the CIA's Clandestine Service. You stress the importance for a CIA officer to be self-aware and empathic. Empathy isn't a quality I normally associate with the CIA. How did these traits serve you in the field?
They were fundamental, particularly in stressful situations, if you don't understand yourself and how you will react. And if you don't understand yourself, you don't have a good reference point for dealing with others. And the empathy you referred to is essential. It's not just collecting intelligence for data or images, but it really is about understanding and mapping the human condition and the human terrain.
Well, in recent years, we've been hearing about differences between the FBI and the CIA's approach to interrogation and other things. And the FBI says it's the agency that uses empathy. The CIA tends to be a bit more coercive.
I think you're referring to a different thing if you're looking at prisoners. My career focused on the recruitment of a variety of individuals to actively work in place as moles, if you will, within these insurgent groups or within these foreign governments.
Mm-hmm. Could you find any moles in Al-Qaeda?
We were able to penetrate, and I still hope have penetrations of Al-Qaeda, yes.
You began working for the CIA in the early 80s, stayed on to the mid-2000s. A lot changed in the world. How important were technological changes?
Enormous, particularly related to unmanned aerial vehicles, and we played a leading role in using the Predator and eventually arming the Predator is one example. Another is cyberspace, how we work in cyberspace to collect intelligence and how that truly is necessary more and more when you look at the human networks and how they're interdependent.
We also would read in the paper about how the CIA tried to upgrade its computer system and failed miserably a couple of times. Is it just too difficult to do that sort of thing?
I don't know of any examples of the CIA failing to upgrade the computer systems. The FBI has had some enduring problems in the last decade. The CIA's database was, in my experience, was always pretty good.
Have certain tasks that used to be done by CIA agents become obsolete with the new technologies?
No. In fact, I think perhaps those skills have been underscored, emphasized, because the world is growing more complex because of these technologies. Therefore, the intelligence requirements are more complex, more demanding.
In 1998, the CIA was actively gathering intelligence on Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. Was that when al-Qaeda attacked the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi? Is that what started it?
Well, even before, the CIA first established an office focused exclusively on penetrating al-Qaeda back in 1996. The embassies in Nairobi and also Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, they were attacked in 98, as you noted.
And then, of course, there was USS Cole.
Right. And in between that, there was a global plot known as the Millennium Plot to attack multiple targets, including Los Angeles Airport. And this was disrupted through a great effort by the CIA and many allies overseas. The Cole came 9 months later in October of 2000.
But we had no inkling of that was about to happen?
The Cole, no. We did not.
When did the CIA's clandestine service begin to recruit terrorists?
Really from the beginning, when it was established back in the mid-1980s.
That has to pose all sorts of challenges, doesn't it? It's quite different if you have somebody who's a terrorist than if you have somebody who is just a civilian. First of all, there's a good chance that the terrorist sees this as an opportunity to actually do more terrorist activity.
Sure, and just meeting the target, if you will. It's a lot easier to encounter a diplomat at some reception than it is to find an al-Qaeda operative willing to sit down and talk to you. And then, of course, further along, you've got the issue of the moral questions. How do you recruit and run a terrorist who, by definition, his aim is to kill people? And how do you work with that type of an individual? Not only from your security perspective, but from the moral imperative.
And he has to maintain his place within the terrorist organization, so he can't look like he's actually working for the CIA.
Exactly.
So you're actually, in some cases, supporting somebody who might do some real damage.
And that is a critical issue. And if you think recruiting a terrorist is hard, keeping one in play is even harder.
Now, what was happening in the White House and Congress at this time? You're going to them and you're saying, the game has changed.
Mm-hmm.
We have this whole new kind of enemy and a whole new kind of danger. Were major adjustments made?
Not until 9/11. If we looked at the terrorist threat being posed really throughout the 80s and 90s, and al-Qaeda specifically with the attacks on our embassies, the attack on the USS Cole, I don't think that the policymakers fully appreciated that threat until 9/11 happened.
There were a lot of reports about how the CIA and the FBI weren't working together in the lead-up to 9/11, and that if they had been more cooperative, perhaps we might have been able to thwart it, or at least had a better idea of what was going on.
Well, there was a degree of cooperation. In fact, I was assigned on loan to the FBI from 1998 to 1999 as a deputy in their counterterrorism shop, if you will. They had a senior special agent in the counterterrorism center at CIA, and there was a lot of resource sharing, information sharing. It was imperfect. However, if you look at 9/11, there has been almost no discussion about the policy failure. The focus has been perhaps 99% on the intelligence failure. In fact, the 9/11 Commission, that was their charter, as framed by the policymakers. And I think we missed a big point there, because the CIA had provided strategic warning as early as the summer of 01 to policymakers, which was frankly ignored.
Well, we get the sense that on the political front, politicians want to hear what they want to hear. And so if the CIA tells them something that fits in with their concept, then that's great. And if it doesn't, then they just ignore it.
They can be very selective. And again, that's one reason I wrote this book, for policymakers and for citizens.
There's also a big difference between the missions of the FBI and the CIA. We'll come back to that and to some of the other things that you write about here and what happened after 9/11. After we take a little break, my guest is Henry A. Crumpton. His book, The Art of Intelligence, Lessons from a Life in the CIA's Clandestine Service. It is published by the Penguin Press. We are back with Henry A. Crumpton. He is the chairman and CEO of Crumpton Group, LLC, which is a global business advisory firm. He was an operations officer in the CIA's clandestine service for 24 years and then served as the U.S. coordinator for counterterrorism with the rank of ambassador at large. We don't want to confuse that with Henry Cabot Lodge. He has written a book called The Art of Intelligence, Lessons from a Life in the CIA's Clandestine Service. It is published by the Penguin Press. We were talking about how the politicians dealt with some of these things, and I meant to ask you about the reaction to what happened with the USS Cole. Was that a call to arms, or did we have to wait until 9/11 for that to happen?
I thought it was a call to arms when I led the CIA team there. And in fact, after I had spent the afternoon in the bowels of the USS Cole with Captain Leopold and saw what had happened.
You had left Africa by that time.
Oh, yes. I had been assigned to the Counterterrorism Center after my stint with the FBI. I got to the Counterterrorism Center in 99. And this was in October 2000 in Yemen. And I came back from the USS Cole after meeting with the captain and seeing the extent of the damage. And I wrote a message back to CIA headquarters saying, well, certainly now we will go after al-Qaeda in their safe haven, Afghanistan. And we did not. And I think this, in fact, emboldened al-Qaeda to continue their operations.
Now, in working with the FBI, we should point out that the agencies have very different missions and do things quite differently. In theory, the FBI is only supposed to deal with domestic issues and the CIA with non-domestic issues, foreign issues. But it can't work out that way, can it?
No, and there is overlap in both directions. You've got many FBI special agents assigned abroad in U.S. embassies as legal attachés. They're a crucial part of the ambassador's national security team in these embassies, because crime is global. And so the FBI has to work that. And also the CIA has officers in the U.S.
You note that one of the big differences between the FBI and the CIA's clandestine service was each organization's relationship with the media. Why do you think the media have become a problem for the CIA?
Well, I think press leaks is number one. And if you have an exposure of a particular source or particular methods, well, then you undermine operations and that can undermine our national security.
But hasn't the CIA's history led the media to be suspicious of some of its activities? I mean, we have the overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran, the overthrow of Arbenz in Guatemala, the overthrow of Allende in Chile, the Bay of Pigs fiasco, Iran-Contra, the overthrow of the government in the Dominican Republic, and a bunch of failures in Tibet and elsewhere. It's hard to trust the CIA when it's had its finger in so many dirty operations.
Well, there have been plenty of mistakes, some of them that you have listed. But bear in mind, the CIA is not this rogue element that forms its own policy and runs its operations without the direction, the funding, and the oversight of both the White House and Congress.
So what you're saying is many of these things were actually done under the direction, at the direction of a president or somebody else.
All of these things were done. For the CIA to engage in covert action of any sort, which is different than just the intelligence collection, which is often the foundation for covert action, the president signs a finding. The Congress has to be briefed.
So you send a message to the president, whoever the president is, there's this issue, this is thing we've discovered. Why do you think the USS Cole didn't spur more action?
I believe that there's a macro point that many policymakers missed. They could not wrap their minds around the fact that this small group of non-state actors, al-Qaeda, on the other side of the world, in one of the poorest countries in the world, Afghanistan, posed a real threat to the homeland. I think if they had, they would have responded. And an example I give in the book is, what would happen if FDR had received a memorandum from his intelligence agency saying that the Japanese will launch an attack against U.S. interest a month before Pearl Harbor? That was basically what happened in the summer of 01. The CIA provided strategic warning.
Some people do think that FDR knew. There are conspiracy theorists who believe everything, that he wanted a war. But we didn't want a war with Al Qaeda.
Well, I disagree with the conspiracy.
No, I didn't say theory, I don't.
FDR.
Gore Vidal believes that. A few other people.
Of course, we didn't want a war with Al Qaeda, but they have a vote, and they had declared war against us. They had stated this publicly. They had demonstrated their lethal intent. They had attacked our embassies. They attacked our warship. And George Tenet knew we were at war.
It's my sense that when the CIA was created after World War II, many of the agents were kind of liberal politically, while the FBI under J. Edgar Hoover was quite conservative. But in recent years, has that changed? The FBI has been quite critical of some of the CIA's methods, especially what's come to be known as enhanced interrogation, waterboarding, and such. You served under Jose Rodriguez when he was the head of the CIA's clandestine service, and he accuses the FBI of lying when it claims that their interrogation methods gained much better intelligence than his group's methods did, your group, when you were in it.
Well, Jose Rodriguez is a good friend, and he's written a book about these enhanced interrogation techniques. And based on what I saw, particularly later on at State Department, when I was a consumer of intelligence, I read intelligence reports that came from Al-Qaeda prisoners, and they were valuable in terms of forming U.S. policy and helping us understand the threat.
And so is it your sense that the kind of interrogation policies that Jose Rodriguez believes in were effective? Or is the FBI right when they say the answer really is to make friends with the suspect, get him to trust you, and then they will open up to you?
I think it depends on the suspect. It depends on the prisoner. It depends on many variables. But ultimately, we as a nation have to make the decision. It's not the CIA's decision about enhanced interrogation techniques or the president or the Congress. But it's America. What do we think is worth our investment, our moral investment, to protect our nation?
Well, some of the more celebrated terrorists, like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, supposedly underwent waterboarding and then didn't give up any really good information. So what is the real reason for doing that sort of thing?
Well, I think it's because many people believe that it's effective.
In the late 80s, the CIA had also established the Counterterrorism Center, known as the CTC. What was its role?
The role was to penetrate in foreign terrorist organizations and to learn about them, their plans and intentions, and then to help inform the consumers, whether it's policymakers or the warfighter or law enforcement officers or others.
And you worked at the CTC?
Yes, I got there in September of 1999.
What were you doing there?
I was the deputy to Kofor Black, and my responsibility was operations worldwide.
You write that there was no greater example of the CIA's global success against Al-Qaeda than the disruption of the Millennium Plot. What was supposed to happen on January 1st, 2000?
Well, there were multiple attacks planned in Amman, Jordan, on the border with Israel, Los Angeles Airport, and there was an attempt, failed attempt, on a USS warship in Aden Harbor. Those are the plots that we knew about. The CIA, under the leadership of George Tenet, and at the Counterterrorism Center, Kofor Black basically uncovered this plot, and part of that was working with our foreign allies, and disrupted the plot. It was a remarkable success.
But we haven't heard much about it.
No.
I think that if you ask anyone in the public, what was the Millennium Plot, they don't know. Why didn't the CIA talk about it?
Well, because the CIA usually does not engage the press unless they have to, unless they're compelled to.
But if you feel that the press is hostile to you, isn't it a good idea to say, hey, look what we did?
Well, that's in part why I wrote the book.
What about the government? Was it providing the necessary resources for you to successfully carry out counterterrorism missions as you saw it?
No, I think there were certain limitations, and the best example of that is in the presidential finding, President Clinton, that authorized the CIA to penetrate and engage al-Qaeda with lethal force, if necessary, in Afghanistan.
That's the months leading up to 9/11.
Oh, in the 2 years prior to 9/11, and severe limitations. In fact, the teams that I started sending into Afghanistan beginning in September of 99, we had to hitch rides on these decrepit Russian-made Mi-17 helicopters that the Afghans had.
And you wanted to establish a base inside Afghanistan.
Yes.
Why did your CIA bosses reject the idea?
Well, I think it was a combination of things. One, resource constraints, and two, the risk.
Well, but you were getting intelligence from people like Ahmed Shah Massoud.
Yes.
He also described as a warlord, but he was probably the person the United States most hoped would wind up becoming the leader of an Afghanistan after the overthrow of the Taliban. The Taliban had him killed through al-Qaeda. Were we aware that that kind of plot was in the works?
Well, no. If we were aware, we'd have certainly warned Massoud. He was one of our best allies. And I don't think that the CIA wanted to see Massoud in a leadership position as the president of Afghanistan. I'd never had that discussion with him, and I don't think that was the expectation. He was a critical partner, as were other Afghan leaders, in building the resistance against the Taliban and ultimately driving them out of power.
At what point were the Predators put into use?
We started using the Predators a couple of years before 9/11 as an intelligence collection tool. And then in February of 01, we had the first successful Hellfire test. And then they were deployed into Afghanistan right after 9/11.
Was it effective in providing intelligence on Osama bin Laden?
It was exceedingly effective. We found him. We captured his image. And I should note, though, that was part of a more comprehensive intelligence collection program, including human sources on the ground.
But they were unarmed at the time. You advocated for them to be armed.
Yes.
How do you respond to criticism of the civilian casualties that the drones have caused?
I think that they have been relatively minimal. If you look at the Hellfire warhead, it's about 20 pounds. It's very precise, and I think it's a highly effective weapon.
Could you have killed bin Laden by using a drone before 9/11?
If we had it armed, yes.
But what happened? Why weren't they armed?
Well, in the beginning, we were using the unarmed drones simply as a collection, intelligence collection tool, and that's when we found bin Laden, had clear imagery of him, and the failure of the U.S. government to respond to our intelligence drove us to seek a technical solution, a lethal solution.
The White House wasn't supporting a program to kill bin Laden and other high-ranking al-Qaeda leaders?
There was a presidential finding, but it was very limited, and for some of our lawyers, unclear in terms of what our authorities really were.
Well, you're saying this was during the Clinton administration.
Yes.
Didn't it continue into the Bush administration until 9/11?
Yes. If anything, the Bush administration offered us less support and focused less on al-Qaeda than the Clinton administration did.
Henry A. Crumpton, his book, The Art of Intelligence, Lessons from a Life in the CIA's Clandestine Service. You write that by September 2001, the CIA had more than 100 human sources operating in Afghanistan, penetrating al-Qaeda and the Taliban, and you had armed and unarmed predators in the air. What was the CIA's mentality at that time? Did you feel like you were prepared and on the ready?
I think we were as prepared as we possibly could be. Of course, there was a failure to provide specific tactical intelligence warning about 9/11 itself. And when 9/11 happened, there was an enormous sense of disappointment and anger and rage.
Well, what was the CIA must have thought about what happened in the previous attack on the World Trade Center, the 1993 attack? Was anybody telling you that it was going to be a target again?
I think that it was clear in the analysis. The Counterterrorism Center briefed the White House in July of 01. A memorandum sent to the president in August of 01 was very clear about the al-Qaeda threat to U.S. interest.
And then after, when 9/11 occurred, did you assume immediately that it was al-Qaeda?
I knew, absolutely.
How did you believe the United States should respond, particularly in regard to the fact that any activity would be certainly sensitive with our Muslim and Afghan allies?
Well, I advocated, and I had the distinct privilege and honor to lead the CIA response into Afghanistan, the U.S. government's response. And it was important that we framed the enemy in the correct way, and we did. The enemy was al-Qaeda, not the Afghan people. And I disagree strongly with people that describe the U.S. intervention in Afghanistan immediately after 9/11 as an invasion. It was anything but. If you look at the defeat of the Taliban and the killing of perhaps a quarter of al-Qaeda leadership, that was basically done in 90 days with fewer than 500 Americans on the ground.
Mm-hmm. But then came the opportunity to capture Osama bin Laden, and he slipped away.
This was in Tora Bora. This was in December of 2001.
Was the CIA involved in that operation?
Yes, with our special forces partner, U.S. Military, on the ground. And we requested more troops, U.S. Rangers, because of the terrain, because of the unique challenge.
And the White House turned you down, Donald Rumsfeld.
Well, I don't know the exact chain of command in terms of who made the ultimate decision. I talked to General Franks about it in Central Command. We knew bin Laden was there. We had no doubt. The intelligence was very good. And it was still a great victory. We wiped out many hundred of the al-Qaeda operatives with just a handful of men, but bin Laden did escape.
And people have wondered why the CIA, with all of its resources, couldn't find him in 10 years.
Well, manhunting is always hard, even here in the U.S. You look at the FBI's 10 most wanted list. Often it takes years to find someone. And that part of South Asia, it's even more difficult. But I'm just pleased that we, working with our foreign allies and the U.S. military, succeeded.
Within weeks of being asked to lead the war against terrorism, the subject of Iraq was broached again. Who was the first to suggest that Iraq should be the focus of a counterterrorism strategy?
After 9/11, the first hint I had was when Deputy Secretary of Defense Wolfowitz raised Iraq. This was in the Situation Room of the White House, and I was confused. I didn't quite understand why he was raising Iraq in this context.
Because nobody in the CIA felt that Saddam Hussein, as terrible as he was, had any connection with 9/11.
No connection whatsoever.
And what was the reaction of other people in the room?
There was general silence, and then Wolfowitz concluded his monologue, and then we returned to the topic of Afghanistan and al-Qaeda.
But then Iraq soon became the main focus. Did the CIA just go along with the Iraqi focus like good soldiers?
Well, I was, in fact, no longer in the CIA then. I was on an academic sabbatical, so I didn't have a direct role in that. But my understanding is that the CIA did not want a leadership, a covert action leadership role in Iraq because of the totally different nature, different circumstances.
And what happened was we kind of abandoned Afghanistan. You were at Johns Hopkins at the time doing a master's in international studies?
Correct.
And what did you hope to achieve by that? Were you going to then apply that information, what you learned, to your work at the CIA when you returned?
Yes. The CIA was very generous. They gave me that year. And it was wonderful because I could reflect on the last 4 years of counterterrorism work to put that in context, to have a better understanding of how the nature of war and risk is changing.
Why do you think the CIA's intelligence on Iraq was so totally ignored? It was just the message that the White House didn't want to hear?
Well, I think there are at least two major aspects. The CIA's intelligence on weapons of mass destruction was just flat wrong. The CIA's intelligence on what would be an emerging insurgency was spot on, and that conclusion was rejected by policymakers, including the Secretary of Defense.
Well, the CIA's information on weapons of mass destruction came from some very unreliable sources. I would have thought alarm bells would have gone on immediately from any experienced CIA agent hearing that stuff.
Well, there was some dissent, but overall the analysis given the policymakers on WMD was incorrect.
So you retired from the U.S. government service in 2007. What was it like to hear that Osama bin Laden had been killed?
There was a sense of grim satisfaction.
And what do you make of the current state of Afghanistan? Do you think that it'll ever become stable politically?
I hope so. The Afghan people deserve it, but we have a long way to go because we failed to address governance, development like we should have, and not just the U.S., but the global community. The Afghan people deserve better.
What about the CIA's relationship with the ISI? Doesn't that complicate the whole situation in Afghanistan?
It's one of the most complex foreign liaison relationships the CIA has. The ISI is, at one hand, a good partner, and on the other hand, a real problem.
Henry A. Crumpton, his book, The Art of Intelligence, Lessons from a Life in the CIA's Clandestine Service. It's published by the Penguin Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.